Investment Management Operations is brought to you by Intelligo. Intelligo is the premier due diligence platform delivering innovative pre-investment background checks and continuous subject monitoring for some of the most sophisticated asset allocators. Their individual and company background check reports blend the critical discernment of human experts with cutting-edge AI, ensuring you receive the most thorough and rapid insights. Groups like Common Fund, Adam Street Partners, Felicitas Global Partners, and past capital allocators guests Hamilton Lane, AIM13, and NEPC leverage Intelligo to mitigate risk and enhance their operational due diligence process. Visit intelligo.ai to learn more. Hello, I'm Ted Seides, and this is Investment Management Operations. This show explores the inner workings of the most sophisticated institutions in the industry. Through conversations with executives across operations, compliance, legal, and finance, you'll hear how key operating partners run their businesses in an ever-changing and complex investment landscape. You can join our mailing list and access Capital Allocators content at capitalallocators.com.
I'm Scott McDonald, and I'm your host. My guest on today's show is Ken Onorio. Ken is the COO of Eagle Point Credit, a $9 billion credit-oriented investment firm. At some level, this is an interview about the softer skills in our space. Having spent time in hedge funds and a tour in fund administration, Ken shares his unique perspective with some key takeaways. Ken discusses his career path and lessons learned while at JP Morgan, Amaranth Advisors, and Sailfish Capital to create a firm and culture built for the long haul. We cover the operational complexities of running credit funds, what it takes to run a publicly listed fund on the New York Stock Exchange, and how to take a partnership approach to hiring third-party service providers as an extension of your office. We discuss how to build culture, employee empowerment, and how Eagle Point promotes from within, and the impact of hiring for attitude, not aptitude. Please enjoy my conversation with Ken Onorio. Ken, thanks for joining me.
I'm really happy to be here.
I'm really excited to talk about what you're doing at Eagle Point to kick it off, and like to hear a little bit about your career path and how you found your way to Eagle Point.
I graduated college from Fordham University in 1990. The first 3 years of my career were in public accounting at Coopers & Lybrand. I got my CPA and then quickly moved on to JP Morgan. I worked in the investment bank for around 10 years in derivatives units, doing accounting and operational roles, FX, interest rate, credit derivatives, equity derivatives. At that point, I felt as though I went through my boot camp of financial services with my time at JP Morgan and my time at Coopers & Lybrand. At JP Morgan, I learned structure and controls. I learned how to work with different individuals across different groups. At Coopers in public accounting, I learned about materiality, which I think was formative in my early career because you need to make decisions, and a lot of times materiality comes into those decisions. I also learned about how important it was to have documentation and support around your records. Obviously, if you're auditing and looking for that stuff, you know what to look for, you learn what to look for. So between JP Morgan and Coopers, I felt it was time to move on. In the early 2000s, I decided to take the foray into hedge funds at a company called Amaranth Advisors. A couple of years later, unfortunately, Amaranth wound down. And then I moved to another hedge fund called Sailfish Capital, which was a credit multi-strat fund. That was in 2006. Fast forward a few years to 2008 and the financial crisis, I had to wind down another hedge fund.
Just to rewind a little bit there, Amaranth had some natural gas trading losses. And what I've experienced in talking to a bunch of my guests who have been involved with Enron, Anderson during the Enron scandal, the Lehman Brothers 2008, what are the lessons learned from those wind downs?
The big lesson is transparency and trust your instincts. What I like to tell folks is everyone has a spidey sense. We're hearing a lot about AI and how AI is going to change the workplace, but AI doesn't have instincts. or maybe at someday it will, but right now it does not. And you have to trust your instincts when something doesn't feel right. You really need to turn over those stones until it does. Sometimes you turn over those stones and you find something that needs to be addressed. And problems don't age. So if there is an issue or if there is a risk change that needs to take place, you need to do that timely. And if I look at sailfish, another thing I learned, and when it's time to be risk off, you need to be risk off. I do remember our managing partners getting up every morning when the crisis first started and instructed all their traders, you're going to pick up the phone, you're going to make a call, you're going to look to do a sale, and you're not going to like the price. So I'm telling you, do that trade, because pick up the phone tomorrow, it's going to be a few points down. So do it now. And I always remember that as being very proactive and getting ahead of the curve a bit. And sometimes a portfolio managers get attached to their positions and need that little nudge to be risk off.
After going through those two events, what was your mindset after that?
So this is where my wife comes into play, just to get a little personal. One of the reasons I went into the hedge fund space or into an asset manager was because it was closer to home, in addition to getting experience and progressing my career, all that good stuff. But on the personal side, it was getting closer to home. I had beginnings of a family. And my wife said to me, Ken, it's great that you're close to home. You're only 20 minutes away versus an hour and a half, but maybe it's time to rethink this hedge fund business. And also, we need some stability. And in almost on cue, I got a call from JP Morgan, someone that I used to work for when I was there in the investment bank, and said, hey, Ken, listen, I know you're probably unwinding and going to be freeing up soon. We just bought a hedge fund back office and we're turning it into an administration business. And you would be the ideal person to run that for us because you have experience on both sides and you have a lot of goodwill with us. Would you be willing to come back? Wanted to go back. It was a great opportunity. It was going to stabilize my career, which I was really looking for at that point. JP Morgan was the employer of choice, if you remember, in 2008, because they had that strong balance sheet. They were very strong through the financial crisis. So I joined and I managed the hedge fund administration business. And again, I learned a ton of things.
What year was this again?
This was 2008, towards the end of 2008. I actually started the weekend after the Lehman collapse. All hell's breaking loose with clients. The first thing you do is you do a review of not only the individuals or the resources in place, but also the controls and the structure. The controls and structure were easy to assess and easy to say, okay, we need to implement A, B, and C. What was more difficult was the personnel, whether the personnel were all in the right seats and whether they were capable of doing their job. So after I peeled back that onion a little bit, I said, oh my God, I remember speaking to my wife again. I don't know if I have the right personnel in the right spots. And it's really getting dicey out there and we have to be able to be on top of our risk and get the right valuations.
And how many people were on your team?
About 100.
So sizable.
Yeah, sizable. And then the story I was just sharing with someone who I brought over from JP Morgan that works with me here at Eagle Point was when her boss came into my office at JP Morgan Hedge Fund Services and said, by the way, I'm an accountant. I'm doing this small role over here. I have some capacity. If you need any help, I'm willing to help. So again, right on cue, there was someone who seemed like they were very capable. And I moved some personnel around, and then we put her in a role of being a primary fund administrator and settled things down a bit.
And how long were you at JP Morgan?
6 years in total. Half of that time was in hedge fund services. There was an individual who I was reporting to at the time in hedge fund that moved into private equity fund administration. Sure enough, I got a call from him about 6 months later and said, hey, Ken, great job in hedge fund services. Private equity fund services is a much larger role. Would you want to join? So I said, absolutely, great career progression. Have the hedge fund aspect down. Let me try private equity. Very happy to do that. Ultimately, I managed a team of 250 people. So it was a much larger mandate. One of the questions I get, Ken, how do you manage 250 people? You really can't. You have to find 5 people that can manage 50 people is a way to manage a large organization. And then another thing I realized is we were on a platform that was outdated. The version of our accounting platform in Investran at the time was a number of versions behind. There was some contemplation from senior management whether or not we should invest in upgrading the platform. Everyone was advocating to upgrade the platform because what was happening is if the platform doesn't work or it's not being kept up to date, everyone's on Excel. And you have this operating model that doesn't work. And when someone leaves the organization, they take all that knowledge with them. So one of the last things I was able to do before I joined Eagle Point was to get that upgrade secured and approved by senior management and implemented.
So you're managing the hedge fund side and the private equity side. What's the big distinction between the two?
In the private equity space, there is a lot more technical accounting that takes place. And the two examples I could think of off the top of my head is the waterfall calculation and subsequent closes to make sure all investors are coming in at day one economics. And hedge fund, a little bit more transactional, a little bit more straightforward from a product perspective, although it evolved since then. I do recall a significant need for technical accountants, technical expertise on the private equity side.
If you're hiring somebody for hedge fund versus private, is it the same approach or how do you tackle that?
Today, it's the same approach. Back in 2008, it was a little bit more bifurcated. Look at Eagle Point. We have a combination of private funds, public funds, private equity, portfolio companies, et cetera. I think it's more commonplace today where you can get a combined skill set or a skill set that's fungible to one or the other.
You did that for a while. So then you had to have another conversation with your wife about going back to the hedge fund days.
And I always wanted to come back into asset management. An agreement I had with my wife, it had to be the right move. I was looking maybe for the last year of my second stint at JP Morgan to come back to Connecticut, if possible, and into asset management. And looked at a number of firms. I would say some of the ones that I would have contemplated joining, I was maybe the second of two choices. There were somewhere I was the first choice, but it didn't really feel right.
I want to pause there because I think this is so important. I think there's a lot of opportunities that you get. And I think people in general are interested in a firm that is interested in you and being liked is a thing that is a human condition. But it's important that you get that right fit. For you, what was the signal that says, I don't know if this is the right place for me to excel?
It's the feel with the people I would be reporting to or working closely with. Someone made a comment once where there was someone already at the firm and they liked me. I imagined that managing this person out. And he said, listen, if you join, we're going to put you and this person in a room. Whichever one of you comes out on top is the one we're going to stick with. So I just thought that was crazy. And I was like, there's no way.
You hear stories like this? So did that person know?
I don't know. It was just told to me in the last round of interviews. And that firm ultimately wound up having problems too.
I think it had problems before.
Before, during, and after. So that was a telltale sign. That's a real exaggerated example that I have. So it's really the feel of the people you'll be working with. And that's on the positive side. That's when I met Tom Majewski, who is the founding partner of Eagle Point.
How'd you find out about the Eagle Point opportunity?
So that role came through a recruiter, and the first interview was with Tom, and it was an immediate click, I think both ways. The two things that Tom told me that really resonated was there were four people at Eagle Point at the time. I was going to be number five, so very early stages. He says, by joining now, you're going to be able to set the operating platform and also help establish the culture. So those are the two things I needed to hear coming out of JP Morgan at the time. And I would say at the point of my career with 20 plus years of experience, I was looking for that opportunity to put my stamp on an organization and combine all this experience into something good, something that I would be able to say is a legacy.
Was it a little bit of a leap of faith? There's words and there's actions. How do you reconcile? Is that person's actions going to mirror their words?
Tom has a great reputation in the industry today as well as back then. The second thing is, Stone Point Capital was the private equity sponsor of Eagle Point. So I met with a number of high-level people at Stone Point who were sharing with me their due diligence on Tom and the opportunity, and in their track record with sponsoring firms such as a startup asset manager.
And how big was Eagle Point at that point in time?
If it was 500 million, it was a lot. Maybe it was between 400 and 500 million. But there was a good plan, and they were a private hedge fund, and they were going to carve out a portion of that hedge fund, I think it was 40% at the time, and use that to anchor an IPO on the New York Stock Exchange for a sister fund of that private fund. That fund today is Eagle Point Credit Company. It's listed on the New York Stock Exchange, ECC. And one thing I was always impressed with was, before joining Eagle Point, was hearing individuals that had the opportunity and experience of bringing a fund public or getting a fund listed on the New York Stock Exchange. I joined because it seems like there was a lot of security in a number of ways, from the sponsorship, from the management partner, who I at the time felt had very good judgment and vision. And then from a job opportunity perspective, it looked like this was going to go public and didn't feel like I was taking too much of a risk other than it being a startup. All the other checks were in place.
Probably a good segue to give people an overview of Eagle Point.
Eagle Point was founded in 2012, approximately $9 billion plus assets under management. 75 individuals work here. Our specialties in the credit space were best known for our CLO investing. That's how the firm started. And as of 2019, I would say that was almost 100% of our assets under management. In 2019, we branched out into other strategies. Largest of those strategies was portfolio debt securities and also some strategic credit investments. We have two public funds with probably $1 billion of those assets under management comprising them, a number of private funds, and probably closing in on close to 100 managed accounts. So a very large complex here. Our CLO assets today are probably half of that $9 billion. So we did accomplish the goal of branching out and growing in concentric circles, is a term Tom likes to use, in the credit space, doing something different but similar to our core strategy.
Interesting. And then on the public side of things, most people are familiar with how a private fund operates. What's the big distinction with being listed?
It's funny, and I know one of your other podcast guests recently said the same thing. There's 2 weeks out of a quarter that are pure hell. From an effort and accuracy and checking everything and managing the board and making sure every last number in your press release and the presentation materials are correct. The investment strategies are the same, but in a public fund, you have to manage to a board. You certainly have boards in our holding company, but from a public perspective, you have a board of very knowledgeable industry experts. My team's job, as well as myself, is to ensure that board is getting transparency to everything that we're doing, good or bad. In certain instances, getting their support, leveraging their previous experience, getting their ideas. And we got a lot of good ideas from our board of directors that we implemented. So that board aspect is one difference. And then the second is you're really beholden to a calendar. And once you announce your earnings release, you just work back 2 weeks or so from that date, you're doing your board preparation, your board materials, and then you pivot to all of your earnings release and earnings material. And that's a lot of work by a lot of folks here that do it very well at Eagle Point.
How does that change the composition of your organizational chart?
You need strong individuals that report into me that can manage not only processes and the information that they and their team are responsible for, but also service providers. So all of those level three assets have a value associated with it. All of the capital movements that take place on a daily basis as we issue stock needs to be accounted for correctly. So you need someone strong who can not only manage their teams, but also service providers, because you could only solve so much of this with internal resources. There's a point where it needs to go external to some extent. So the team is critical.
Do you need more legal expertise given the credit space that you're in?
So we need a legal expertise from a 40 Act perspective, someone who knows the laws and all the regulatory requirements. Also need a compliance team. We have a strong compliance team that knows everything that we need to do from a compliance perspective. And then your fund accountants are really front and center on all of that public disclosure and materials.
You have the public side, you have the private side. I'm guessing you touch on all the operational aspects of the organization.
That's correct.
Every COO is a little bit different. Where do you touch and what do you not touch?
I have a higher touch on the public materials and the public information. So heavily involved in leading the effort on any sort of capital raise. So leading that effort with the underwriters or our other agents that are issuing our shares. Doing the last check or maybe the second to last check in all of our numbers and press releases and investor presentations and scripts that we're disclosing. And a little bit less on the private side, where I would say our chief accounting officer really plays that role of being that last check on materials and myself coming in when needed or when something is a little bit complicated, either requires guidance or a second look. But my high touch on the finance side is really on the two public funds we have. My core responsibilities are the non-investment team / marketing components of the organization, as well as managing all of our third-party service providers. Another area I have a high touch to is tax. Tax on the public side issuing 1099s is quite straightforward. You got to collect all the underlying information and pull the right info, but a little more straightforward than a partnership, which has a lot more complexity associated with it. And then risk and human resources and technology and compliance to round it out.
Given the approach for CLO credit in general, for those who don't know, how much more operationally intense is an Eagle Point credit strategy over long equity?
It's a lot more operationally intense. And there's a couple of things that are unique to credit. One is you're typically dealing with illiquid level three assets. So illiquidity, there's challenges on two fronts. One is on operationally, if you're looking to exit a position or even to expand or deploy capital, the opportunities might not be there to enter a position or exit. And then on valuation, there's really no observable levels unless you're doing a trade close to or right after the measurement date. And that's where service providers come in. We have valuation agents that help augment our valuation process. So those are the two big things that are significant. I would also say on the non-CLO strategy, it's non-homogeneous. A lot of our counterparties are all a little bit different. They all require additional due diligence, different contracts, different controls, different oversight. It's harder to scale. It's really hard to make it push button and straight through processing.
It's complicated level three. So you have to rely on third parties to do that, which makes me come back to, given your history being on both sides as a service provider and the client, how do you think about third party service providers?
The accountability of anything that we do here at Eagle Point, as well as whatever our service providers produce, is really with the team at Eagle Point. And we look at our service providers as an extension of our team. I'll stick with the valuation agents, for example. Deep level three, they have expertise not only in the asset itself and how to value it, but they have exposure to the rest of the market. In some instances, and they're seeing observations or things that we don't have color to, but it works the other way too, where we have insight and we're happy to share that and they share it with us. So there is that level of expertise that doesn't put all of the burden on the team here to compile that information, but it allows us to outsource a good portion of it, which is always subject to our review. So that's where service providers come in. I would say most all of our service providers have been here since I've been here. Some of them predate me. Our administrator, our lead valuation agent, our auditors, our tax compliance, those were in place before I joined and is still with us today.
How can you assess that your service provider is doing the job that you need it to when you know that nothing's perfect?
The first thing is our service provider deliverables to us are on a calendar. So the first thing is, are you getting it on time? So sometimes there's a legitimate reason for something being a day or two late. But if it's chronically late, it's telling you one of two things. They're either having an issue with whatever they're looking at, or there's a staffing problem or a staffing shortage and the resources aren't in place to make the deliverable. So the first thing is, are you getting it on time? And if you're not, you do that exploratory call to the right person and say, hey, what's going on? If they say, sorry, a little bit behind, you'll have it all tomorrow and it shows up tomorrow, that's great. If they say, well, I'm not really sure, let me get back to you, I have to check with the team, and you get something that's different than someone else said, there's a problem, and then you get all hands on deck call to say, okay, guys, what's going on here? We have a hard stop, a hard deadline. We're very dependent on you producing this information. So the first thing, if it's on time and if there's a good reason for it being late and it shows up shortly thereafter.
And how important is it to share the Ken Onorio user manual to your service provider?
Our chief accounting officer, she works for me at JP Morgan Hedge Fund Services. So I brought her along when I joined Eagle Point. We say, hey, we're in your seat. We know there's staffing issues that pop up every so often. We know there's quality control issues that pop up. Let us know. And then another thing, I always end that call with saying, how could I help you? Do I need to call someone else to get you resourcing? Is our rate card a problem? Do we need to, in this area here that you seem to be choking on a little bit, do we need to provide you a little bit more resources from a capital perspective to go hire someone to do that role properly? So we always end that call after we escalate, how could we help you? And that really solidifies the partnership. And we do it from a genuine place of being in that seat.
What's your take on the industry? Do people think about partnership with their service providers in the same way that you do?
I would say more often no than yes. My only source of information on that is what the service providers share with us. I think they generally enjoy working with us and they give us that feedback and it's reciprocal. We feel the same way about them. Obviously, it's a 10-year plus relationship in some cases. They share stories. I won't speak for them, but I can't believe what I'm hearing, that they're treated in a certain manner. And I think that helps us because you're always going to gravitate towards the person who treats you nicer or the entity that treats you nicer.
I want to shift over to culture. I know that's an important topic for you, and maybe give your thoughts on what culture means to you and Eagle Point.
Very important to myself. If I had to critique some of my former roles, the culture probably wasn't the most optimal from where I was in the organization. And as you're progressing in that organization, if you don't have the right culture, you get to a point where you may have to compromise your values to move ahead. So you never want to be in that position. So the first thing I would say about culture is it's not by luck that it comes together. When we hire a few people that I know, and we hire some people that think the way I do, it's not that easy. It's by design. And a lot of times that design out of the gate doesn't work the way you want it to work, or it's not working for some reason. You made a bad judgment here or there, and you got to persevere. Ultimately, it comes together. That's one thing I could share with people listening to this, is cultures by design. Design it and stick with it, because ultimately it comes together.
What is culture in Eagle Point? What's that flavor? What are you looking for that match?
The fabric that I think keeps everything together is an entrepreneurial mindset, not only in how we work with our investors and how we approach investment opportunities and strategic opportunities. It's how do we build a team? What's going to make that team happy and sticky over time? And it has to be genuine. You just don't want to do it to check a box and then you tell people about it when they're interviewing and they show up and it's something different. The culture is you want people to be happy and fulfilled in their job. There's a couple of ways that I use to make that happen. The first and foremost is empowerment. The one thing I tell senior people when I hire them is we're not hiring you to tell you what to do. We're hiring you to tell us what to do, what we're missing, what we're lacking, and how we could do things better, how we could do new things. So that's empowerment at the senior level. When you get into the lower ranks, empowerment is giving them opportunity to progress their careers within Eagle Point. They don't have to leave Eagle Point to get that promotion. They don't have to leave Eagle Point to get a bump up in pay. You want to be ahead of that and promote from within. That's a very easy way to build a good culture, is if someone might not be ready for an opportunity, but they're raising their hand and they're willing to take that risk to do that role. And you look at their resume, we need someone with 10 years, they only have 6, but they're a good citizen, they're showing a lot of promise, let's give them that chance. And when you give them that chance, you need to be invested in their success. Meaning you don't just say, hey, go do it and let me know how it works out. You have to be with them till they have that confidence, they build that confidence, and they're able to run that responsibility by themselves.
What about managing expectations? I think there's this theme that if I do this for 2 years, I should automatically be up. How do you manage that?
Real-time feedback is something we provide folks, whether it's good or bad. So that helps. Hey, that was a great job. You're looking to be in this role in a few years. Keep doing that. That's on that trajectory. Or, hey, you want to be doing this. What you just did isn't going to get you there. So you have to clean that off. And then what I do is I have an annual lunch, a solo lunch with individuals on my team that aren't my direct reports. I have a meeting with my direct reports on a regular basis, but their directs I only see throughout the office when there's something coming up and I speak to them, hello. But that lunch meeting is really about their career and what they're expecting. And I said, listen, and it usually it's skip level, right? Their manager isn't there. So they're telling me what they're looking for. I had a 5-year plan when I joined Eagle Point. I'm on 3 years. I don't know if I'm halfway towards where I want to be. Great feedback. Let's give me some time to work with your manager and others to make that happen. So you need to know where people stand. And as a manager, a lot of times you have to fish that out as a senior manager. And sometimes you do it on a skip level basis where the individual might feel more comfortable telling you, or they might have raised it a few times and really didn't get the response that it warranted. So it's fishing that out and really trying to help them achieve those goals.
You guys have grown. You said you're $9 billion today. How do you scale culture?
The key is when you have a culture that everyone is buying into, and I would say it's noticed outside of our organization also, not just within the organization. You want to bring people in that are going to be accretive to that culture. And everyone's looking for that during the interview process because everyone wants to keep the culture intact. So the key is when you were hiring, bringing the right people into the organization. Once in a while, you get a miss. Like I said, no one bats 1,000. But most of the times, we're getting it right. The second component is I learned very early on with my time at Eagle Point, if I use the same recruiter for most of our hires, and this is on the investment operations side, they're going to know who fits also. There's a few people at Eagle Point where we had a role, a job description, the person didn't fit the job description, but the recruiter called and said, listen, this person may not fit the job description, but I think they're fungible, but they're definitely going to fit the culture to that attitude. And we hired those people and they're doing very well here. The key is getting the right people in and maintaining the people that are here. We have very low attrition at Eagle Point, so we're sustaining the people here. As you bring the right people in, my directs and their directs are delegating down, so they're freeing up capacity to do new things as the firm grows. And the right people always looking for something new to do. There's something challenging to do. It feeds itself with the right people in place.
One related question I have is, so you're in Greenwich, which is, some might say, the hedge fund capital of Connecticut at a minimum. Is it competitive? I'm not sure how many funds there are today.
It's very competitive on the resource front, getting the right resources. A lot of times we lose people because by the time we get to them, they have three other opportunities in hopper. And despite our best efforts, we just can't get there quick enough to be competitive with them. And to our advantage, the culture wins people over too, because there's a reputation and a buzz about Eagle Point that all else equal, we get most ties in the recruiting process. But it is challenging, a lot more challenging today than it's been in my recent memory of getting good resources in. But we'll always be patient and wait for the right person. We'll never rush into a hire that we know is marginal and may not work out.
So Ken, this has been really helpful. I want to close out with two questions. And one is, what advice would you give to an emerging manager from an operational perspective?
A couple of points. What was successful for me at Eagle Point was to have the buy-in from the top to build that platform, not only in service providers and technology, but also people. And we always said, I was always getting pushed to be plus one on resourcing. So if I thought I needed a team of four people, I was told to go hire five. I need 9, 10. So always be plus one on resources and make sure you have that buy-in and you're not catching up too much to growth. But the best plans to stay ahead or stay in pace with it don't work out, but you'll be a lot closer than if you waited too long. So always be plus one on resources and ensure you have buy-in. And as I mentioned earlier, is build those partnerships with your service providers because they will help you scale over time and bring a level of expertise you may not have early on in a firm's existence. Succession of your team, build those partnerships. And the third is, I think it was helpful with us here at Eagle Point, is we have all those functions you should have in a $9 billion firm today. But that wasn't always the case. As we were growing, myself and the compliance officer were doing most of the HR duties, whether it was reviews or personnel matters. And it got to a point where it was getting too much. And we said, okay, we need an expert. We need to bring in the expert. And we went and hired an HR director. And thank God, because as we went from 40, 50 people to 75, that HR need really picked up. So know when you are about to burst at the seams on a role that's pretty important to the organization and hire it in. You could only do it by committee for so long.
There's always that inflection point of you go through these periods of stress and then it's like a wave. You go up and as long as it goes back down, you're okay. But if the wave continues to build, then maybe you need some added help.
They also bring in a level of expertise. They will say, hey, we need to be doing A, B, and C, which wasn't even a thought to myself or the compliance person at the time.
And then my other question is, what industry resource, could be a book, website, Twitter account, do you most often recommend to people?
The one I recommend is the High Growth Handbook. I think Elad Gill was the author. I read that about 5 years ago, and that was a book that Tom gave me around the holidays, I guess as an end of year gift. And the reason it resonated with me, I think I read it at the right time because Eagle Point was no longer a small asset manager. They started just to get into the emerging growth aspect. I think we were at 45 people at the time and started to get into different platforms. And I read it at the right time. It's a lot of good advice of how an organization goes from, maybe so called, the 0 to 100 people, 100 to 500, 500 to 2,000, and a lot of context on why certain roles and certain approaches are needed. I learned a lot from my role and the psychology part. I learned a lot about How does that impact people from the beginning versus people that just joined? It's different psychology.
Ken, this has been a fun conversation. Learned a little bit about culture and what you're doing over Eagle Point, and I appreciate the time.
Anytime, and thank you, and really enjoyed the conversation today.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you like what you heard, hop on our website at capitalallocators.com, where you can access past shows, join our mailing list, and sign up for premium content. Have a good one, and see you next time.